In the days of Abraham, where things were much more simple, there was a measure of obedience in response to the direction of God. Whereas there were problems, people did not always behave themselves as they should. The general climate in those days was one of submission to God. Thus, if Abraham were out of order, it only took a word from God to put him back and put him in the mood of realizing he needed some change, you know, that he had something to do here. But in the period of the Judges, after the children of Israel got into the Promised Land, as it is called, and they began mingling with the idolatrous pagan nations or ethnic groups around them, there was a larger and larger gap between the Word of God and the obedience of His people. Thus the need of the establishment of a government, a more specific form of government. And when the people wanted a king, God was ready to grant it because they needed at that point someone like that. That is foundational to the realization that God established government for the orderly control of the unbeliever, more than for the Christian. This is stated pretty clearly in Romans 13. Governments exist to keep the godless in order because there is no other basis of appeal. In this day, the universal idolatrous and disobedient action of Israel made it necessary for God to supply a substitute in terms of a physical king and an organized government to keep them in line, because they weren't listening to God. They weren't listening to Him, so He had to have a more fleshly expression of government. Whereas what was originally His intention was that He should guide His people and they should respond to Him, and He would be the government. That's what we call a theocracy. Theocracy is a form of government in which God rules through the expression of a prophet, like Samuel. Samuel would have been the ideal form of government as a prophet, much like Moses, who functioned as a prophet. Organized, orderly government in Israel evolved with the coming of kings, of the kings of Israel, which emerged in the book of Samuel. Orderly government evolved in Israel out of the realities of a people who were no longer listening to God. That's what it's all about. So Samuel was a stopgap here. Came then the kings, and because the people needed this kind of government, and God allowed them to have this kind of government, they tasted the consequences of that kind of government, and Samuel had predicted it. He said, if you get a king, he'll take your sons off the war, and he'll do this and this, and that's what happened. That kind of government. Whereas if they had stayed with God and stayed open to Him, they would have fared much better. They were not ready for that. God then is establishing a government here. He's got to have some way of guiding His people. So the first step, of course, is Samuel, the prophet, who is God's spokesman to the people. Now, Samuel was lived 1100 to 1050 B.C. At this period of time, around 1000 B.C., you have the beginning of the decline of Egypt. Assyria begins to take precedence, or take the ascendancy. The Mesopotamian kingdoms were taking the ascendancy, and they, in fact, were the ones that became the scourge of Israel. The southern group, the people of Judah, were carried off to Babylon in the ultimate captivity, and the people of Israel in the north were carried off, taken away from Samaria, that is, they were dispersed throughout the Mesopotamian region by the Assyrian king, Sargon II. So here's where Samuel comes into the picture. Now, the people are settled in the land has been divided. They've chugged along under the judges like Samson and Gideon and the lightweights there for a few years, 100 years or so. And now they are about 100 years, I imagine. Now comes into the picture Samuel, who is the forerunner of the kings who will be the historical structure or skeleton of Israel's history. God is still speaking to his people. He's still on speaking terms. That is an important point. The day will come when he's not going to be on speaking terms with them. There is a limit to divine grace. People sing songs about unlimited grace of God, but it is not really theological. It's nice to sing about the limitless grace of God, but there came a point in Israel's history when the grace was limited, and they stopped, and they were carried off to Babylon. And God was silent for 400 years. Now, God brings to us his presence, and he opens up to us channels of communication, even today. He teaches us. He ministers to us in the Spirit. He provides channels of instruction. But there comes a time, if people are unresponsive to what he provides, there comes a time when he may bring silence. Now, that's not an easy limit. That is to say, the threshold is far out. God put up with Israel for 1,000 years before he finally lowered the boom. So percentage-wise, you can see that there's an extension of God's mercy that is very great. And he does reach us by his mercy. But there is a limit. And the nation of Israel, the history of Israel, proves to us two things. One, that God works greatly with a failing, faltering people, and two, that there are ultimate limits to his grace. Those are both two sides of the coin. We've been dealing with the one side of the coin to show you how God does put up with human frailty. But there's a limit to how much he is going to put up with it. Sometimes people reach those limits. All right, so now we come to Samuel. Samuel is in that period where Israel has been in the land for about 100 years. They've gone through these weak judges. Now comes a mighty man of God. During this period of time we've just been talking about, there was no one around that was really a giant of the faith. Joshua was a giant. Moses was a giant. Abraham was a giant. But we don't meet any in Judges. Now we're coming to another giant, which is Samuel. And we will meet some more. God gave them another chance. We will meet Elijah shortly down the road. And we will meet Elisha. And we will meet the Isaiahs and the Jeremiahs and the men of that stature. And then we will hit another slack time where you're going to have 400 years that there's nothing from God at all. They're just totally left to do their thing. Then comes Jesus into the scene, and we've got another giant, and more than a giant, of course. All right, now for Samuel. The name of this man, Samuel, means God hears. And the story of God's hearing is crucial to the whole issue of Samuel, and we meet it in the first three chapters of the book. Before we actually come to that, I'll just give you a brief outline of the book. That you have in this period of time, the emergence, as I indicated, of a king in Israel. And the process of acquiring this king, the first king, which was Saul, and the subsequent reign of Saul occupies the first 15 chapters in this book. The first of the book, the first three chapters, bring us the coming of Samuel into the picture. Then comes the first king, Saul, who was anointed by Samuel to be the king over Israel. Then in chapter 17, David comes on the scene and replaces Saul for reasons that we will get into. After David comes on the scene, you have another giant, even though there were areas of problem, which we've outlined in some degree before. But David was a giant of faith, a giant of a channel of communication between God and his people, and he was a prophet king, David was, which is evident from the Psalms. So he was a great man of God. Well, the first book of Samuel, then, for the rest of the book, talks of the reign of David, or at least the early, not exactly so much of the reign as the coming to power of David, the early life and his problem with Saul and his wilderness wanderings, and then the beginning of his reign. The death of Saul is recorded for us in the last chapter of 1 Samuel. And along with that section, you have the coming up of David. Then the second book of Samuel is altogether taken up with the reign of David. So that's where we sit in terms of the general outline of this book. Now, David comes into power somewhere around 1050 B.C. Going to the first chapter, there are some things. We'll probably spend several nights on this first section of Samuel because there's a lot that is crucial here. Chapter 1, verse 1. Now, there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, and the son of Elihu, who was the son of Tohu and the son of Zuf, the Ephrathite. Now, Mount Ephraim was located somewhere in the region of Bethlehem, between Bethlehem and Bethel, very close to Jerusalem. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, the name of the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Shiloh was a city, a town located north of Jerusalem. It was the locale of the ark after it had been brought over to Canaan. And that's where it was sort of the seat of worship of these people, the Ark of the Covenant. I don't mean the Ark on the Ararat, I mean the Ark of the Covenant. And so that was the place where of worship until later on that David removed, brought the Ark to Jerusalem, and it was then later placed in the Temple of Jerusalem, which went through several buildings and rebuildings. So this man went up to Shiloh. It says, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. That is itself a significant statement because these two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were blackguards. They were rascals and dishonored the Lord greatly by the way they handled things. To give you a very practical illustration of how they handled things, it would be as though the pastor of a church had a couple of sons that would go through and fleece the congregation. It's that type of activity on their part. They would might say, well, we're taking up a collection for something, and they're pocketing the money. It's that kind of bad action. And the point here is that Eli was putting up with it and later on was severely judged for that. But once again, when it says Hophni and Phinehas were there, it's almost a little shot there that says things were not all as they ought to be. See? Now the time was that, now let me go on to say this. Why did God judge Eli for the misbehavior of his sons? Well, because if they were fleecing the public, the congregation, he should have put a stop to it, and he didn't. He can't help that they were bad boys, but he could run them out of the temple. He had to. Now it says that when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion. That means he gave her an extra double amount. For he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. Now you might ask, why did the Lord shut up her womb? And the answer is going to be very evident. He wanted to bring about a certain effect, and the only way he could bring it about was to shut up her womb. Now, verse 6 gets at is a hint of why this happened. It says, and her adversary also provoked her sore for to make her fret because the Lord had shut up her womb. Now, I'll translate that into usable language and terminology. The Hebrew text here reads that her enemy provoked her or troubled her exceedingly. The Hebrew construction there says sort of like, and provoking her, he really provoked her. In other words, he provoked her exceedingly in order to cause her to thunder. Now, that's the literal translation, but to sort of rage over this thing. It wasn't just a little fretting. See, the reason I went into that is because our word fret doesn't do justice to the thing at all. He really brought about a condition of turbulence within her. We'll see why shortly, I think. And as he did so, year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. That is, she was provoked. And therefore she wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou? Why eatest thou not? And why is thy heart grieved? Am not I better to thee than 10 sons? You know, good old Elkanah was trying to, smooth it over for her. And it was good. It was nice that he did that. He was doing what he ought to do as a husband to bring about a comfort for her, and so he just tried to make up for it. But it wasn't good enough, and God didn't allow it to be good enough. And we'll see why. So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. Now, that doesn't mean she was bitter at God. It just means that she was deeply troubled here. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy handmaid and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. Now, here's the reason that God allowed this to happen. Now, Hannah, of course, as you already probably have gathered, was the mother of Samuel. I'll get ahead of the story a little bit to tell you that Samuel was born to this woman as a result of her prayer, but by this whole problem that she confronted, by this turbulence and tumult in her life, the purpose was accomplished, which was that in her desperation, she offered this child to God. If the child had been born a natural birth, that would not have come into the picture. But this was crucial for Samuel because he had a special touch from God and was taken almost immediately, that is after he was weaned, was taken to the temple, and there he was schooled in the things of God and became the leader of Israel, of Israel at this time. So the reason God allowed Satan to do it, now God didn't trouble her, but he allowed Satan to do it, and the reason God allowed Satan to do it was that he wanted to elicit from her, he wanted to evoke from her this response of saying, all right, Lord, it's your child if you'll give it to me. Now, the application of that to ourselves is that God allows things to happen in our lives which seem to be extremely devastating to us in order to bring about desired effects. And you may not understand why it's going that way. It's a very negative matter. To you, you think it's a tragic thing and a distress and everything. But God is fulfilling his purpose in our lives, and he does bring about these things. One of the commonalities here in terms of young people, for example, or old adults too, but often with young people, they seem to be going way off on a tangent, and the parents are naturally concerned about it, and they pray and so forth. But I've had to often say, well, God may let this young person go a long way down before they're ready to turn back, you know, and he's got to allow them to run their course. I would not like to say that they are like fish, but if you know anything about fishing at all, you know that in order to land some of these fighting fish, you sometimes have to let them just run with a line, and you try to wear them out. And God lets people just run with a line, and lets them act ugly and ornery and rebellious and everything and kick up them. Finally, he just zaps them so hard that they are now ready to turn around and act and behave themselves. That's just a common way things go. Now, as far as Hannah, it's a different kind of thing because she was not out of order at all, but I'm saying that he allowed Satan to trouble her deeply and to affect her life deeply and allowed misery in her life year after year. It wasn't just something that happened 1 year and the next year they had a child. It was a year by year this happened. That's who vexed her, was provoking her enemy, taunting her, the enemy of her soul, taunting her because she didn't have a child. In those days, that was, of course, a much more serious thing than today. Today, for many people, it'd be a blessing, unfortunately.
But it wasn't Benaiah that was...
No. This process worked to the glory of God. That's the thing I've said to you before. Satan must get awfully frustrated sometimes because the more he does to clobber the believers, the more he simply promotes the things that God wants to promote. And the adversities that hit us believers, they're hard to go through, but in the end, things happen that cause the work of God to go forward. Just to finish this one section, and it came to pass as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. Now that's an extremely important point. Old Eli here has gotten off base. His sons have been a death knell here. He's allowed this thing to go on in his household, and he hasn't done anything about it, and he's defended his sons and tried to justify them, apparently, or at least he's not done anything about it, and he has lost his sensitivity. Of all people on earth, Eli should have been sensitive to what was going on with Hannah. And he comes along, hey, what's the matter? You drunk or something? You know, how come you're doing it? It reminds me of the time I was taking a train as a young fellow. I had a custom of bowing my head for a moment before a meal, and I was on the railroad car, and I was eating dinner there, and I bowed my head to pray, and a porter, the waiter, came up, and he kind of shook me and said, "Hey, what's the matter? Are you sick or something?" Eli was so far off base that he was not sensitive to the things of God. And I'm reminded of many, many pastors of churches that if you went to them with the kinds of statements about the Lord's guidance to you and so forth that we often share together here, they wouldn't understand it at all. And that's why a lot of times things that we say here, the pastors brand me as coming from Satan, you see. I mean, they're so far from God that they can't understand the simplicities of what we're trying to do here. If something's coming from Satan, he's certainly not going to be lifting Christ up to the degree that we do, see. But they're so far off. All they can think of are programs and promotions and all this kind of thing. So we look like mad people in that respect, madmen. The Spirit of Christ, or the Spirit of God, I should say, which should have been the portion of Eli, because even though the people did not have the Spirit generally, as I've pointed out before, as we do today in the new era of things, but the priest had the Spirit, or should have had the Spirit. And Eli, of all people, should have understood this. But anyway, Hannah answered and said, "No, my lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto." Here's a woman coming in sorrow to worship and not understood by the priest. And once again, you have the point that we've tried to make many times before. You do not have to express worship in hilarity. Everybody doesn't have to smile. You should be able to go into a meeting somewhere and be at peace and be able to carry your grief and move in a context of quiet sorrowing, if necessary. There should be a place for tears for a person to sit in a meeting and be in sorrow. But that is not often allowed. I should put it differently and say that some people think that that's a sign of defeat if you're not just being very hilarious and ebullient. So, but then Eli comes through in a certain sense. Verse 17, "Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went away and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad." Now, Eli, nevertheless, in spite of this insensitivity of his, was the instrument of God that was available at that time. And God did speak through him to Hannah, perhaps in the same way that the donkey spoke to Balaam in the incident where Balaam was trying to go and put a curse on Israel, and the donkey rose up against him. At least he was going to serve the king of Moab. The point is that God did use Eli as a channel of communication here, in spite of his lack of spiritual sensitivity. Now I'm reminded of something that takes place in the New Testament where the Sanhedrin has been called together, and the chief priest, this is in the Gospel of John, the chief priest is very upset because of the impact that Jesus is having upon the people, and he makes the statement to the rest of the boys there in the Sanhedrin. He said, when they were soft-peddling the problem, he says, "Don't you know anything at all?" He said, "Don't you realize it's better that one should die for the people than that all should perish?" And then John makes the observation by the Spirit's leading, I'm sure.
He says, this he said, not because he really understood, but because being high priest that year, he prophesied the death of Christ. It wasn't because he didn't say this of himself, but it was because the Spirit of God used a dumb ass mouth, a jackass, as in the case of Balaam, you see. Or it says the dumb ass spoke. And the Lord used that mouth, which was not accustomed to uttering truth, to nevertheless speak a word of truth. Now, I doubt not that many ministers or many pastors who normally speaking may not be living according to the realities of their faith, yet on occasion a word comes through them that brings about salvation, maybe on a number of occasions. They're speaking the word of God, nevertheless, even if they're off base. In other words, a lot of people have been converted through evangelists who turn out to be opportunists and been bilking the people. And there are a lot of the people on the media that whose tactics might be subject to a lot of review, but nevertheless a word is spoken and the people out there in the audience who don't have any knowledge of this other thing may get the word and be saved by it. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're always living the way they should. Anyway, Eli then tells her to go in peace, that her request is answered, and God used him to say that word to her, because then she had peace in her heart about it, and she went her way.